Accession number 30633, Mr. James Farquharson, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Farquharson?
I was born on the 10th of February 1920 in Weymouth, Dorset.
And could you tell me a bit about your family background, you know, what your parents did, what sort of family
yes.
you were from?
My father was in the Royal Navy. He served in the Dardanelles and was awarded the DSO for a fairly courageous exploit there, taking a ship through a minefield on orders during the Gallipoli era campaign.
Did he talk much about it? Did he ever talk much about it?
Very, very little. I wish I'd asked him many more questions. I think most people think that when it's too late.
And his war experiences changed him? I know you didn't know him beforehand, but do you think it has had an impact on him, or was he...
He was not inclined to go back to reunions and that sort of thing. Once he was out of the Navy, which was in 1930, having been on half pay for various periods to do with the Geddes Axe, I think it was called, after the First World War, he became... he worked for the church for some time afterwards on charitable organisations, and eventually was recalled for the Second World War as a retired captain, and was put in command of a converted liner, the Bibby liner Shropshire, which was renamed HMS Salopian, equipped, he discovered, with I think 2 guns, that was its total armament, and they were guns that he had served many years before in the battleship Exmouth. It was a cause of considerable amusement to him at the time to meet old friends. He, in the early days of the Second World War, he went out as a convoy escort in late 39, right at the beginning, to Dakar and Accra, I think, on the African coast. And then at Christmas time, he was back in Devonport, and we went down to see the King and Queen go aboard the ship on a sort of state visit, which was quite exciting. And then he was sailed again into the Arctic on patrol, and I believe that his ship, the Salopian, relieved the Royal Pindi. No, the other way round. The Royal Pindi relieved the Salopian and was sunk very soon afterwards by, I think, a pocket battleship. And it was commanded by Ludovic Kennedy's father. And in the early spring of 40, which was a particularly cold winter, he was called back because all the reservist recalled captains were going to be given shore jobs and taken ashore permanently, and in sailing up the Clyde in the night in foul weather, a ship, I think it was a Finnish cargo boat, and I think the cruiser Norfolk as well, a cruiser, collided on the famous bend in the Clyde, I think, and I suspect that my father's ship ran into them both. Anyhow, it was damaged, and so in fact he was involved in boards of inquiry and that sort of thing for some time afterwards, and was totally exonerated. I mean, it was nothing to do with him and no responsibility. And after that, he was given shore appointments. Captain M.L., as it was called, based at Brightlingsea in Essex. No, first based in Chatham. And then in the Battle of Britain, he was moved across because things were pretty hot on the Thames Estuary on that side. He was moved to Brightlingsea, and his responsibility then was commissioning ML's motor launches from which were being built in small shipyards up and down the east coast. And I think his stretch of the coast was from the Humber to Dover, and that was 1940, and by 43, I should think, he had complained bitterly that the crews that were being delivered to him were very often not properly constructed, and he would get half a dozen cooks or something to man a ship. And so the answer to that was, right, well, if that's how you feel, you better go and do something about it yourself. And he was made captain of HMS Attack at Portland, where he had served at the end of the First World War, when it was called the Anti-Submarine School, on the development of radar. What was it called in those days? The ASDIC, the sonar. And he saw the war out there, in fact, first being in charge of an organization training crews, and then being rather overtaken by the run-up to D-Day when the Americans came in force, and they sailed for a great many of them from Weymouth and Portland, and more or less took him over. I mean, he had American sailors in his wardroom and that sort of thing. And he was eventually retired in, I suppose, in the spring of 1945. And after that, was out of the Navy altogether. And then he worked for a time. He had worked, incidentally, from 1930 to 1939, when he was recalled, principally as the Secretary and Treasurer of the Diocesan Board of Finance in Salisbury. And went back to that for a very short time when he was released in 45, but I think he realized his heart wasn't in the job any longer, and he could perfectly well totally retire. And so he simply became a gardener, grew vegetables and that sort of thing.
Now, what about you and your mother? You were born in 1920.
Yes.
Did you stay in Weymouth while your dad moved around? Or?
No. Well, yes and no. My mother, they married in 1919, having delayed marrying till the war was over. And she was the daughter of a landowner in West Worcestershire, close to Tenbury Wells. And she had worked for a time in the First World War for MI5, and also did various other charitable jobs in the course of the war. And after that, when the war was over, they married. First thing was the arrival of myself, and my father was still, of course, serving then, and spent some time in Devonport, and I rather believe, as a very small child, I was taken for a short while to Plymouth, but I remember nothing about that. And he then served in HMS Vernon, which I forget what its particular function was, which was a shore station on Whale Island, I think, in Portsmouth Harbour.
Torpedoes and things like that.
It probably was, yes. Sounds very likely. And then,
did you move there with him?
No. We continued to live in Weymouth. We moved house twice, and he commuted. I mean, he bought himself an Austin 7 and trundled to and fro, came home for weekends. And he was then moved from the Vernon to be a commander. He was a commander then. He retired with the rank of captain. He was put in charge, in fact, of a training organization on the other side of Portsmouth Harbour. Alverstoke, I think, was the place. HMS... it was four old warships, decommissioned warships, all tied together with little gangways, bridges across from one to the other. And it was a training organization for artificers of various kinds.
It might be impregnable. I'm not quite sure, though. I should remember. I've interviewed plenty of people who were there.
It wasn't impregnable. One of the ships, the four ships, was called Sparshot. I remember that. That, I should think, was a heavy cruiser, the sort of ship of the era when the ships tended to have four funnels.
Did he join the Navy in 1914, or had he been in
He joined the Navy, and he was born in 1884. He joined the Navy at the age of about 12 or 13. And
1896?
Thereabouts, and was trained at HMS Britannia, Dartmouth. And then served, I don't know the full details of his service before the war, but he was went about the world and became flag lieutenant to Admiral Sir Ashton Curzon Howe, who was commander-in-chief of the Home Fleet or something like that, and was largely based in Portsmouth, had the unfortunate, difficult task when Curzon Howe died suddenly of a heart attack, I think, aboard ship. My father had the awful duty of going up to Yorkshire to break the news to his widow, which he did so well that the widow became my brother's godmother, and it was a lifelong friendship, including her family.
So he'd had a successful career in the
Navy. Oh, he had a very successful, yes.
Except for the Geddesack experience, you know.
Yes.
Now, what about your life in Weymouth? How comfortably off were you in Weymouth? Your mother was just looking after you, really. Was she all with the brothers and
sisters? She was looking after me, yes. She was a keen amateur singer, so she did a lot of singing in local choral society and things like that. We were very churchy. We were great friends with our local vicar, who became a bishop in the end, at Holy Trinity of Weymouth. And she did all sorts of work for the parish. And in fact, after my father retired in 1930, almost the first job he did was to organize a great, I forget what the celebration was, but a big sort of garden fete, rather more than that, a sort of festival for the church in Weymouth.
So it was a comfortable. Were any brothers and sisters?
Yes, I had a brother who was born 5 years after me and ended his career as an ambassador. I think by their own standards, they would consider that they were very, not at all well off. We could never afford to have a holiday, for instance. I mean, the best holiday we had was to go up to my mother's old home and spend a month or so with her parents.
Did you have servants or a big house? Or
That was a big house with servants. They even had a butler in those days. But I mean, as far as we were concerned, we lived in a large semi-detached house with about four or five bedrooms, and we had two resident servants, a cook and a house parlourmaid.
So middle-ish class,
yes.
Lower middle class, whatever, somewhere in there.
We would have called ourselves gentry in those days.
But not well-off gentry.
Not well-off, no. And one of my mother's favourite sayings was, we'll have a new car. We had a desperate old bull-nosed Morris. We'll have a new car when our ship comes in. That was a great uncle of mine, my father's uncle, who was a racehorse owner and trainer on Salisbury Plain, who actually died in about 1937 or 8. So we were able to buy a new Wolseley car about 6 months before the war began.
So you had did you enjoy your childhood in Weymouth then?
In many ways, yes. I mean, it was a wonderful place to be brought up. We lived in a house in a suburb of Weymouth, a residential suburb south of Weymouth called Rodwell, on the way to Portland. And our house had a panoramic view of Portland Harbour and the island of Portland behind it. And I became passionately interested in the Navy and ships. And the great occasions were when the fleet came in and the whole place became full of warships. And incidentally, I was invited with other children to children's parties aboard battleships and that sort of thing. I remember seeing Felix the Cat in a film show on the deck of HMS Marlborough, I think it was, at the age of about 4 or 5. And I was absolutely free. Do you know, we never even locked the front door at night. In those days, our house had a big front garden. You were on the main road to Portland, and I was at liberty. I used to get up in the summer in the small hours of the morning, dress, go out, and walk all around the harbour shore, or down into the town, into Weymouth to see the sunrise and things like that, and back home again. And on many occasions, as far as I remember, I then undressed and crept back into bed and pretended I'd never got up. But it was a blissful existence.
And what about your education?
My education began, I suppose, in about 1925, when I was 5, in a very small kindergarten, almost next door to the little house in which I was born, off Rodwell Avenue. And there I was taught by a redoubtable old battle axe called Miss Fisher, with, I suppose, about 10 or a dozen other children, mostly sailors' children. And that lasted until the end of 1928, And January 29, I went to a private boarding school at Langton Travers near Swanage on the Isle of Purbeck.
What was it called?
The school was called the Old Malt House, founded in 1906 and closed ultimately in 2007.
And that was at Langton?
Langton Matravers.
How do you spell Langton?
Langton, L-A-N-G-T-O-N.
And Matravers.
And Matravers, it doesn't have an L in it, it's Matravers, M-A-T-R-A-V-E-R-S.
What was the education like there?
The education was very simple. We learnt Latin, we learnt Greek, maths, very simple, all the basic subjects, geography and things like that. The school was well run by the standards of those days, rough and ready. I don't think parents ever interfered in the way the school was run. Our headmaster was a distinguished footballer. He'd played for the Corinthians, which in those days was a sort of England team, amateur team, with I think two of his brothers with him in the forward line. And his father was the vicar of Tame in Oxfordshire. Elijah Corbett, he was called, and Rex Corbett was my headmaster. And there I was, having a reasonably good education, being involved, suffering from a certain amount of bullying when I was first there, but one lived that down.
What kind of bullying? Because it varies in...
It varies. In my case, it was a curious thing. It was a sort of campaign by the two boys, one of whom was a cousin of mine, who sat on either side of me in the form room and used to grab my school notebook and write threatening remarks in it. Silly remarks, which were very largely connected with a school play, which had been written by one of the masters. At the moment there was a break, they used to grab hold of me, blindfold me, put me in reins, and drive me around the grounds of the school, threatening me, you're going to fall into a bed of nettles, and things like that, which of course seldom happened, but I was absolutely terrified of all this. It absolutely blighted my existence.
What year did you go there?
I went there in January 1929, and this bullying went on, I suppose, only for a couple of terms or something. And I forget, it was never found out, but it just stopped for some reason. I mean, they gave up. I think, yes, they gave up because, in fact, I did eventually trip over a wall and fall into a bed of nettles. That, I imagine, frightened them off, and they gave up. But for the rest, it was a pleasant existence with all sorts of interesting features. In the spring term, unusual for almost any school, I think, we played no games. We went down to Woodlands in a valley behind the school where the old Purbeck marble mines were, and there we built stick houses on a sunny bank just outside a wood. A rare feature of the equipment list that parents had to provide when you first went there was a hand axe. Every boy had a hand axe, and that was to chop the timber for building their little stick house. And otherwise, the other great feature apart from...
And would you live in them? Or was this sort of, not live, but was it sort of camping thing like the scouts, or what was it?
The school...
Was it just an exercise in building a hut?
No, we never slept out. I mean, these huts were simply built... It was a sandstone bank. We used to excavate caves and then build a sort of wattle screen, if you like to call it, round the outside, the usual sort of thing. And... This was in the spring term, and as it became spring-like and there were warm afternoons, and we finished making our house, we just went and sat in it, and as far as I remember, just idled about and then went back to school for the last class in the day. And in the summer, the great feature there was learning to swim in a place called Dancing Ledge, which is now, alas, very touristy. In those days, was entirely private. It was a great rock ledge at the foot of the cliffs on what now is called the Jurassic Coast. And the headmaster, there were three private schools. The management was all related in the village. And the senior one, called Tom Pellett, had blasted a swimming pool out of the rock ledge. And we, at mid-morning on a working day, we would run down about half a mile, I suppose, across the top of grassland, and then slither down a slope to the ledge and swim for about 10 minutes or a quarter of an hour, and then dress and rush back for the next class. And when you were first there, until you did your length, which generally you did in about a fortnight, you were taught to swim by the headmaster and his assistant, holding out a pole with a loop on the end of it. And when you'd done your length, you were then taught to dive. And thereafter, if the conditions were suitable, you were allowed to dive off the rocks into 40 feet of water in the open sea and swim round in a semicircle. It was sort of, the ledge sloped down, so the sea lapped over the lower end. So you dived off the high end, came back at the lower end, and there was only once a slight disaster when the sea became, well, I think there was probably a sort of tidal wave, but nobody knew much about that in those days. We just said every seventh wave was a bigger one than the others. But suddenly the whole ledge was swamped in water, and one or two boys were quite badly scored. It was incredibly rough stone with limpets all over the place, that sort of thing. You could be excoriated if you were scraped across the top. But that was the only time anything ever went wrong, as far as I remember. And the teaching varied, of course. There were one or two.
I wondered how academic it was. I mean, you know, what...
It got scholarships to the main public schools. I suppose Winchester and Marlborough were the two principal schools.
So how did you do academically there?
I did academically.
I know you're quite young still, but...
I did, I should say, quite a bit above average at that age. Partly because of the... it depends on when your birthday comes. Mine was awkwardly placed for going in for a scholarship, and so I wasn't put in for a scholarship. Oh, and the headmaster always assumed that I was going into the Navy, and so I was not taught Greek, which I always regretted afterwards. Another thing about that school was there were, as I think for many people, there was one master who was an absolute inspiration, you know, and one would never forget him. He did one enormous amount of good.
And who was he in this case?
He was a young fellow who, he can have been only about 20 or something like that. He was a scholar of Brighton College, and he had the strange name of Jack Jarchow, J-A-R-C-H-O-W. I don't know if that was Polish or something. A very bright man. I mean, a polymath, as they say. He was a brilliant sportsman and could teach us. Nobody else I've ever known could teach, could inspire you. And the sort of thing I particularly remember, of course, was not so much in the classroom as out on the cricket field, where he would get us all catching the ball from a catching cradle. He would throw the ball and we'd all leap and catch it. Or he would, with a tennis racket, he would hit a ball up almost into the clouds and we were expected to catch it as it came down. And very quickly, we all almost always did. It was all very enjoyable. And then I...
Which subjects did you like most at that stage?
At that stage, I should say, the subject that I never enjoyed much was history. I should say Latin and simple maths, which were really arithmetic in those days, I enjoyed most.
What about sport? I mean, it's funny this term out of building a sort of hut in the side of the...
Yes.
But what about what other sports did they play?
Well, the sports, regular sports in summer, of course, cricket, and in the autumn term, association football, I mean, the soccer. And we played what were called sixes. We had made little teams, competitive, a sort of league in the school, and we put up one or two 11s to play on Saturdays against other local schools. And the Swanage area was absolutely crammed with schools of that kind in those days. They're pretty well all faded away now because the whole educational system has changed. I mean, in those days we were all boarders. Now they're all day children, and the catchment area, of course, on the coast is very limited. And so the schools all went bust one by one, and mine did last year, having just survived its centenary.
There was no... you'd be too young there for any cadets, officer cadets there.
There was nothing like that.
Because it's only a prep school, isn't it?
Yes.
I should have asked before, when you first got there, did you suffer from homesickness, or were you always that very quick?
Not real homesickness, but certainly a certain apprehension. I remember my mother drove me there and delivered me much too early on the arriving day, so that I was left there miserably sitting with nobody else around, and then the bus arrived from Swanage Station or something, and crowds of boys poured into the school, all saying, "What did you do in the holes?" and that sort of thing, nobody paying the slightest attention to me. And all that was rather galling at the time, and bit by bit I somehow accepted and got involved. There was a very, very good headmaster's wife who was a very motherly character, and we were all called by our Christian names, unusually. That was all part of...
How many boys were at this school, roughly?
In those days, approximately 50, which was... the school was viable at 50. It reached a stage where it had to have over 100 for it to be viable later on.
And you were there from... So you were there from
1929 to the end of 33.
And now, when then?
January 33, I went to Harrow, having passed in on common entrance, and experienced the same sort of misery on arriving there. My father delivered me much too early. I remember the housemaster coming round and seeing me sitting all on my own in the room I was going to share with two other boys. He said, "What are you reading?" And I said, "I'm reading Oliver Twist." He said, "Oh, that's very good." I was doing exactly what was expected. And that was a harsher existence, certainly.
In what way? I mean, was the bullying there?
There was no bullying at all. I think that's perfectly true. I mean, there was, I suppose, bullying about the school. In my own house, I can remember no bullying at all. But the discipline was very strict.
In what way? Tell us about the
well,
discipline.
Well, there was fagging, of course. And that dominated one's existence.
Now, people now, I mean, it was quite common even 20, 30 or 40 years ago. But fagging doesn't exist a lot now.
No.
Can you explain how the fagging system worked for you at Harrow?
Yes, I think so. It was all organised by the head boy of the house. The housemaster lived on the private side through a baize door and prided himself on not interfering with what went on unless absolutely necessary. And so the fagging system... involved various duties. The main duty was day boy, and you were a fag, incidentally, for your first four terms, and then after that, if you reached the upper school, which was a certain level, you ceased fagging, and if you were still in the lower school after seven terms, that was the end. You stopped fagging anyhow. I stopped quite easily at the end of four terms.
And what would you actually have to do?
What you had to do was, as a day boy, there was a list put up on the notice board, the names for each day of the week, and in all spare time, when you weren't up at school in class, you had to be in the house at any of the six monitors, as they were called. Actually, in my house, they were called privs for some reason. Could, if he wanted anything done for him, he would shout "boy" at the top of his voice. And the day boy ran at once to him, and he was said, "Please take this message to the head of the headmaster's house," or something like that. And you then did that. And the moment you were given a job like that, you looked around the house to find the next person in who was down the list, ideally tomorrow's day boy, and you said "on boy," and you then rushed out and did your errand, came back and said "off boy," and that was the way that went on. Now in a